This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart. Coming up, calls for a specialist medical assistance team from Australia to be dispatched to Fiji as a matter of urgency as the country's COVID-19 outbreak continues to escalate. How the Australian government's plan to open the door for farm workers from Southeast Asia could have a negative impact on the Pacific's labour force. And no vaccination, no play. A very clear message has gone out to the National League soccer players in Fiji and Papua New Guinea. Those stories to come, but we start in Fiji, where the COVID-19 outbreak continues to escalate with more than 1,200 cases recorded so far and record-breaking numbers being recorded almost every day. One of the features of the COVID updates for the last few weeks has been what has come to be referred to as the Navy cluster. It apparently began late last month when a large group of naval officers are understood to have breached coronavirus restrictions by attending a funeral. But as Liam Fox reports, despite the rising number of infections linked to that occasion, there's been no official word on what happened or whether anyone has been disciplined.
According to the daily updates, nearly 50 new COVID-19 infections have been linked to what's called the Navy cluster in the last week alone. It all began last month when, according to reports, more than 50 naval officers from the Walu Bay Navy base attended a funeral service in Nasori, just outside the capital, Suva. Witnesses told Pacific Newsroom they visited the funerals in groups of 20 and while at the service drank kava from the same bowl using the same cup. That would have been in breach of restrictions on funeral gatherings that limit attendance to just 10 people. The Permanent Health Secretary, Dr. James Fong, appeared to reference the event in his daily briefing on the 28th of May, just days after it's alleged to have happened, when he said funerals were the most troublesome spreader events.
Our investigations have indicated that in some instances, some of these funeral gatherings went up to 100 persons. And what was done was that they split up the 100 persons into five bubbles of 20 persons in order to appear to comply to the requirements of funeral gathering. We need to stop twisting and turning our COVID-safe measures to suit our own personal agendas.
That's the most anyone from the government or military has had to say about the event. But there are those who want answers, like opposition MP Linda Tambuya.
To date, there are still no answers forthcoming from the military, from the government, the Minister for Defence himself, as to what has happened to those officers.
In Parliament recently, she tried to ask the Minister for Defence, Inia Serui Ratu, what happened.
He just got on his feet and lectured us in Parliament about, why are you targeting the military officers? Why are you targeting the Navy? They're working so hard to contain COVID and to do their part. So it was very defensive. There was no responses in terms of our queries.
The commander of the Fiji military also responded to Ms. Tambuya's queries, sort of. In a statement, Rear Admiral Viliami Naupoto said she should apologise to the military frontliners and their families who are selflessly fighting this invisible and deadly disease. He did not refer to the funeral incident at all, either to confirm it or deny it. Ms. Tambuya says she won't apologise and maintains the military needs to be more transparent.
We see every day members of the public are breaching protocol measures, are breaking curfew, and they've been lugged into court and their pictures in the paper charged with offences. So, if the law is going to apply, it needs to apply equally to everyone.
One person with an insight into the culture of the Fiji military is Seremaya Tuitefi. He served as an officer for more than 30 years and retired in 2013.
Maybe the commander has been told not to comment. If he reveals a lot of this, and his job is on the line, that's the culture that we have in this country.
Mr. Tuitefi says soldiers are doing valiant work to support the effort to contain the spread of COVID-19. But he agrees the military needs to be more transparent when it comes to possible breaches of restrictions.
They are civil servants. They're paid for by taxpayers' money, which means that the paramount thing in their job is that they should be responsive to the people they are paying, the public. But unfortunately, that's not the case in this country.
The ABC has contacted the Fiji military, the Ministry of Defence and the Minister for Defence for comment, but there's been no response.
That report from Liam Fox. Meanwhile, the ABC understands the Australian government is considering a request from Fiji for additional support, including the possibility of dispatching an emergency medical team like the one that was sent to Papua New Guinea. OSMAT, Australia's specialist medical assistance team, responds to health emergencies during national disasters and now pandemics, and is capable of deploying complete mobile hospitals. The man in charge of OSMAT, Professor Len Notaris, says his team is on standby.
During this time we've been in PNG, we have people still in Timor-Leste. We are talking about the Southwest Pacific as well, and we may well be called upon in the next few days to have a significant presence there.
Dr. Ungalu Sukubula is a medical practitioner with Fijian heritage who has been living and working in Australia for the past 20 years. He would like to see an OSMAT team dispatched to Fiji as soon as possible.
I think the sooner the better, to be quite honest. Before we get to the 200s and the 300s, the one thing that is helping, and I'm not sure, you know, my epidemiologist colleagues might disagree with me, but Fiji has a very young population, and perhaps we're not seeing the ravages of the Delta variant that's going through there at the moment, because the majority of those that are being infected are young, healthy individuals. And we'd like to keep it that way. We'd like to make sure that those who are affected are just those that can brush it off after the appropriate treatments and things, and that we're keeping it to them rather than passing on to those that are most vulnerable. So from my perspective, OSMAT being involved, look, I think that Fiji needs to ask Australia, and Australia needs to go, the sooner the better, to give them a hand, to give my colleagues in the frontline a reprieve, and to provide that much needed support for Fiji at this time. Critical.
How concerned are you about the outbreak that spread across most of the main island of Viti Levu?
It is concerning, considering that it is the Delta variant, very virulent, and also does appear to cause, incredibly sort of serious effects, particularly for those that are most vulnerable, you know, those with chronic diseases. We do know Fiji does have higher rates of chronic illnesses, particularly diabetes. So it is concerning. I am particularly concerned too about the widespread conspiracy theories, the anti-vaccination stance. I am buoyed by the fact that there's about 42% from the data coming out of the Ministry for Health yesterday, 42% of the population that's eligible to be vaccinated have already been vaccinated. So that's reassuring to know. But still, there is a lot of work to go, and I know that yesterday they had about, I think, 121 cases, which is a record high. These numbers are alarming, and it is concerning. I absolutely, am worried about what's going on, particularly in the highly populated Suvarnasuri corridor.
And touching on those conspiracy theories, in your mind, do you think people are taking it seriously? You know, it does seem that people are breaching restrictions, large crowds at funerals. You know, from your interactions, do you think that people are aware of the seriousness of COVID-19?
I don't think they do. There are even members of the public out there who don't think the SARS-CoV-2 virus exists and the disease COVID-19 exists. That is a worry. The other issue there is, Fiji has, as we know, has a very young population. So that's probably a protective factor to a certain degree. But the fact that people aren't taking it seriously, calling it a hoax, that it doesn't exist, that is very deeply concerning indeed.
Dr. Ungalu Sukubula, he was talking there to Marla Damadi. Critics of the Australian government's plan for a new visa for farm workers say Pacific Islanders will lose out if it comes into effect. The agriculture visa will be offered to workers from Southeast Asian countries in the hope of filling Australia's labour gap. But as Jordan Fennell reports, one Australian farmer who supports the government's move also has concerns about the impact it will have on her existing workforce, who are from Solomon Islands.
When COVID-19 border closures caused a labour shortage in Australia, Karen McCarthy says that it was seasonal workers that saved her farm.
We were very lucky to have our Solomon workers already with us on the ground when COVID hit, and they opted to stay with us throughout the whole season, and we certainly would have been lost without them.
For the last 8 years, her Queensland farm has employed workers from Solomon Islands exclusively under the Seasonal Worker Program.
We adore them. The community adores our Pacific workers. They're certainly have brought economic value into our own little regional town as well. That's where they spend their earnings. And they're very well respected.
Despite programs like this bringing in workers from the Pacific, farmers still need more hands helping with their harvest.
We need more workers in Australia. We're so productive. Agriculture, horticulture, you know, we've got the very best produce here in Australia. We just need the help to get it out of the ground and onto your plate.
They've been calling on the government to fill Australia's agriculture labour shortage for years. And now the government has responded, announcing a new visa will be offered to the 10 Southeast Asian countries that make up the ASEAN Economic Union. But the Australian Minister for Agriculture, David Littleproud, says eventually it could be opened up to more countries.
This is a new ag visa that will supplement and complement the seasonal worker program and Pacific labour scheme.
Details of the agriculture-specific visa have not been confirmed, but it's understood to be part of Australia's new free trade deal with the UK, announced by Prime Minister Scott Morrison.
One of the biggest challenges we have, particularly in COVID, is when there's such restriction on movements of people, we need to meet those workforce challenges to ensure our primary producers in particular can make the most of the linear agreement we've agreed here today.
Under the deal, British backpackers will no longer be required to work on farms to extend their holiday visas, with the ASEAN countries expected to make up the labour shortfall. But the director of the Development Policy Centre at the Australian National University, Professor Stephen Howes, says if the visa comes into effect, seasonal workers from the Pacific will lose out.
It will compete with the SWP and the PLS. You know, obviously it's easier to recruit from a large economy like Indonesia and Vietnam than it is from Vanuatu or Tonga. So once you open up the scheme to those larger economies, employers are going to flock there rather than to the Pacific.
Professor Howes says the visa announcement reflects poorly on Australia's relationship with the region.
You know, the Pacific Step Up is one of the flagship policies of this government, and at the heart of the Pacific Step Up is labour mobility for the Pacific, and extending the seasonal worker opportunities beyond the Pacific is obviously going to undermine the SWP and, you know, antagonise the Pacific. So you really wonder whether this announcements being thought through from a strategic policy.
In Vanuatu, opposition MP Matai Seremaia has also voiced his concerns.
Provided that now there will be competition, I think the government needs to really look into it and see where the problem arises that gave to the idea of Australia moving to the east instead of the Pacific.
And Mr. Seremaia is calling on Australia to prioritise its relationship with the Pacific.
We are in a situation where we really need to see our big brother in the Pacific to look after us by giving us the opportunity. But again, ourselves as the government need to look into policies that will be beneficial for both Australia and Vanuatu in relation to the scheme.
And while Kerry McCarthy says any announcement of more workers is a welcome one, she worries about the impact it could have on her recruits from Solomon Islands.
You know, I am concerned about the detrimental effect that a huge influx of ASEAN workers may have to both the seasonal worker program and the Pacific labour scheme. Certainly with new workers coming in from the ASEAN area on the new ag visa, we would certainly need to see some similar mechanisms in place for those workers as well.
Kerry McCarthy, a farmer in Queensland who employs seasonal workers from the Solomons, and the reporter there was Jordan Fennell. I'm Richard Hewitt, and you're listening to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. The United States has announced plans for a multi-trillion dollar fund that will pay for infrastructure development in low and middle-income countries across the world, including the Pacific Island nations. The arrangement is being seen by many as a rival to China's Belt and Road Initiative, with its focus on infrastructure like roads, bridges and wharves. But as Evan Wasuka reports, there's concern the US initiative could also ramp up geopolitical competition in the Pacific.
Several countries in the Pacific have signed up to China's Belt and Road Initiative. So some think the new infrastructure fund from the US and G7 countries might provide some pushback to China's growth in the region. James Batley is a former Australian diplomat in the Pacific and now a distinguished fellow at the Australian National University.
I don't think it will increase tensions. I think from the Pacific, the point of view of Pacific Island governments, they will see this as another opportunity to leverage further assistance in areas where it's really needed. So, you know, there's I don't think there's a downside in it for Pacific governments. It's possible that it will sharpen the sense of strategic competition, not only in the Pacific, but elsewhere around the world, I think, because, the way this is expressed, it's clear that it is, in some senses, being set up in contrast to the Belt and Road Initiative.
In Solomon Islands, where the government switched diplomatic ties from Taiwan to China in 2019, the announcement is being welcomed by opposition MP Peter Ken Laurier Jr.
I think it's fair to say that a lot of these perhaps more leading democracies were focusing very much on, should we say, soft outcomes, focusing on building up our institutions, capacity building there, rights, human rights focus. And all of that is well and good. But I think for developing countries, especially small island countries like us, hard infrastructure is really where it's at. I, for one, don't see them mutually exclusive.
The Solomon Islands government did not respond to the ABC's request for comment. But Mr. Ken Laurier, who used to head the country's foreign affairs ministry, doesn't think there'll be much interest from Prime Minister Manase Sogavare's administration because China is funding sports facilities for one of its biggest priorities, the hosting of the 2023 Pacific Games.
There's certain leaning that the current government already has. It's very clear for some of us in terms of where that leaning is towards. So I think the government would be unwise to lean too heavily on one particular angle. And I think we should welcome this option with open arms and look to work with everybody for the benefit of Solomon Islands. I think the bottom line is interest of Solomon Islands, not the interests of these foreign powers. They are powerful. But the idea is that they're partners and we should drive the agenda.
In Kiribati, which also dumped Taiwan in favor of new diplomatic relations with China and signed up to the Belt and Road Initiative, opposition leader Tessie Lambon says the U.S. announcement is good news for her country.
We do welcome it because there is a great need for support for our infrastructure development. And I'm talking about ours in Kiribati and in the Pacific and in other small island developing states. There is great need for that. And, in the past decades, we have seen low investment or low support from the, let's say, the G7 or the developed economies towards these. And I guess most of the investment have been directed through multinational organizations or international financial institutions.
Ms. Lambon says while she is thankful that the US and G7 members are stepping in now, she would have liked to see an arrangement like this 10 years ago.
That's Evan Wasuka reporting. And finally, the president of the Fiji Football Association, Rajesh Patel, has confirmed that all players, men and women, will have to be vaccinated against COVID-19 if they want to take part in their respective national leagues when competition resumes. And players in Papua New Guinea have been warned they too will have to be immunised if they want to be involved in the National Soccer League with the new season due to kick off on July the 17th. Back in Fiji, meanwhile, the FA has stepped in to provide food and supplies for full-time players and their families who are struggling as the coronavirus outbreak gets worse. Mr. Patel says they are a family, so the association are doing everything they can right now to help those family members who are in need.
An average of about 20 to 25 players per club. We've got 22, 23 district associations, and they're being helped. And it's not only men, both men and women who are helping now.
So by the sound of it, then, the majority of players who would far rather be playing football in the local competitions are doing it pretty tough at the moment.
Well, yeah, some are totally dependent on football as an income for them, and the district associations have got under them. But we, as a parent body, we have to make sure that in difficult times, we do our corporate responsibility and social responsibility program together with it. Before, we had previously done for the hurricanes and cyclones, and this is a foundation that I've started. It's Football for Hope, and for future generations and future, whoever president comes in, this Football for Hope will be there, and it will be a like a charitable organisation for the football players.
And when it comes to the relief effort, Mr. Patel says soccer's regional and world ruling bodies have also had a role to play.
It is from our FIFA coffers that we have saved, and also from FIFA and Oceania. Certain restrictions have been lifted off so we can help the football family and the football players, and that's how we are funding it. It's about $160,000 that we will be giving in the second phase of food rations, and so that's what we're looking at.
Right now, no one knows when Fiji's national soccer competitions will resume, but in Papua New Guinea, their new NSL season is on track for a July 17th kickoff. And acting competitions director for the PNGFA, Rosie Suai, says there's a chance now that more clubs will be involved than they were planning for.
The number of teams that have shown interest is more than 10. So teams that have paid the expression of interest fee, I have already put them through to the top management and the NSL steering committee. I told them I need some answer before the 17th because the teams will have to know whether they are participating.
Is there a possibility then that the competition could even be bigger than 10?
If the NSL steering committee as well as the PNGFA top management wants that to happen, then they will allow that.
The level of interest is remarkable when you consider that matches will be centralised in Port Moresby and Lae. That means teams from outside the two main cities have to be prepared to set up a temporary base if they want to play.
We have teams that have shown expression of interest from Sipik, from Wewek, from Deng, also Tabu Bil, but I understand Tabu Bil has come down to Port Moresby, so the Sipik Medeng one have to be based in Lae, which is closer to the provinces. If they are going to be participating, they will have to be based in Lae because the games will only be played in Port Moresby and Lae.
But before a ball is kicked in PNG or in Fiji, players are being told they must get vaccinated or they won't be allowed to compete.
It's not only themselves they have to make the choice, but if they want to play in the competitions, we have to protect other lives as well. As a responsible citizen, we have to make sure that the sports stay free of COVID and we can return back to normal as soon as possible. Right now, we don't know what the sports commission is going to make a decision, how they will bring it about the reopening of the sporting events and everything. So this is something we have to preempt it and make sure when they do open it, we are ready with the players and it's safety for everyone.
In PNG too, that will also apply. So as it is now, once I know which team are participating, they will then be told that these are the requirements that the Office of the Deputy Controller has come back to soccer with. They have to comply with those restrictions, get vaccinated and all that.
So there is no choice in the matter. If a player wants to play, they have to be vaccinated.
At the moment, they have to be vaccinated, just like rugby league did. So all the sports have been advised that the competition can continue. They have to be vaccinated, yes. And I think the officials as well, plus us, the staff of PNG Soccer.
So what's been the reaction from players to being told that COVID-19 vaccination is compulsory for them? So far, Rajesh Patel says no one has lodged a formal objection.
They haven't complained to us anything yet, and most players are happy to go with it because they know it's for the safety of their family and also others too.
So each player, presumably when they return to their clubs as and when the competitions resume, they will have to have some proof of being vaccinated before they can play again.
That's right. The certificate they give, if you've got your first dose, they give you, so when you'll come and get the second dose. And once the second dose happens, there's another date and stand there that you have taken both the jabs. And this is something that they'll have to show us.
And would they be able to play, depending on the timing of the competition coming back, having had the first vaccination but not the second? Because clearly there is a bit of a time lag between the two.
Yeah, they can play after the first jab.
In PNG, Rosie Suai says once the lineup for the NSL has been finalised, there will be rules put in place to ensure that no unvaccinated player takes to the field.
We'll be arranging that with the respective team managers and we'll also work together with the Office of the Deputy Controller.
And at this stage, there's nothing to suggest that the season won't start on time. The rugby league season is up and running now after, I think, a three-week delay, so that would tend to look good for soccer.
Yes, it looks good for soccer because due to what rugby league was experiencing, all other sports know what we have to go through in terms of COVID-19 protocols, the new normal.
That's Rosie Suai, the acting competitions director for the Papua New Guinea Football Association, rounding up this edition of Pacific Review. I'm Richard Ewart, and as always, thank you very much for listening.